kind of tight.
Hey, let's call this conference committee to order. This is the conference committee on Senate File 2470, having to do with medical cannabis and therapeutic research. Welcome, everyone. You folks know the subject matter that we're dealing with. A lot of news on that today. Madam Co-Chair, why don't we just very quickly go around and introduce ourselves, and we'll get started with a walkthrough of the delete all that's before us, the DE4. I think copies are out on the table for the public from House Counsel. So we'll start with you, Matthew.
Matthew Bergeron, Committee Administrator, House Health and Human Services Policy Committee.
Representative Rod Hamilton from District 22B, southwestern part of the state.
Jamie Olson from House Research.
Representative Carly Moline, Chief Author of the House Bill, represent northeastern Minnesota.
And I'm Scott Dibble, Senate Chief Author, and represent southwest and a little bit of downtown Minneapolis.
Katie Kavanagh with Senate Counsel.
Ken Backus with Senate Counsel.
Suzanne Sabatka, Committee Administrator for Senator Dibble.
Ted York, Legislative Assistant to Senator Dibble.
Tony Laurie, State Senator, District 11.
Midway between here and Duluth.
That's right.
Or three quarters of the way.
Mostly the I-35 corridor between.
And we have wonderful staff over here, and they can just wave. Very good. Thank you. When we have you start the walkthrough.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through the DE4, which everyone should have in front of them. Section 1 amends Chapter 13, which is the chapter on data privacy, and is more of a technical addition to the list of data privacy statutes. Section 2 is the definition section. It's new proposed coding in Chapter 152, as all of these sections are. Some of the notable definitions in this section, you can start on page 2 at the top. Subdivision 6 is the definition of medical cannabis. And medical cannabis includes extracts of the entire plant of medical cannabis and only in a form delivered as a liquid, including but not limited to oil, a pill, or a vaporized delivery method using oil. It also allows the Commissioner of Health to add other methods, but not to add smoking as a method. Subdivision 8 is the medical cannabis product, and that includes all of the supplies related to using medical cannabis. Subdivision 11 allows for patients to have a registered designated caregiver, and there are qualifications for who can be a registered designated caregiver. The person has to be at least 21 years old, does not have a conviction for a disqualifying felony offense that is also defined in this section, and has been approved by the commissioner to assist a patient who has been identified by their healthcare practitioner as developmentally or physically disabled and therefore unable to self-administer medication. On page 3, subdivision 14 is the qualifying medical condition. Qualifying medical conditions for these purposes include cancer, but only if the underlying cancer condition or its treatment produces one or more of the following: either severe or chronic pain, nausea or severe vomiting, or cachexia and severe wasting. Other qualifying medical conditions include glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, Tourette's, ALS, seizures, including those characteristic of epilepsy, severe and persistent muscle spasms, including those characteristic of multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease, a terminal illness, which is defined as having a probable life expectancy of under 1 year, if the illness or treatment produces one or more of the following, and is the same list that applies to a diagnosis of cancer. And finally, the Commissioner of Health is allowed to add any other medical condition or its treatment. Section 3 of the bill provides for limitations. The bill does provide for criminal protections for patients, caregivers, parents, and others allowed in the bill to possess medical cannabis. Section 3 provides limitations to those criminal exceptions, and it prohibits any person from engaging in anything that would constitute negligence or professional malpractice. It also prohibits possessing or engaging in the use of medical cannabis on a school bus or van on the grounds of any preschool or primary or secondary school, in any correctional facility, or on the grounds of a child care facility. Section 3 also limits where a patient can vaporize medical cannabis. Those limitations include on any form of public transportation, where the vapor would be inhaled by a non-patient minor child, or in any place and in any public place, and includes a definition of a public place. Section 3 also provides limitations for operating a motor vehicle while under the influence of medical cannabis, and states that it does not require medical assistance or Minnesota Care to reimburse for those expenses. Section 4 allows patients in Minnesota to join a federally approved clinical trial if one does come into existence in Minnesota, and it allows the Commissioner of Health to not allow any of those patients into the registry program that this bill is creating. Section 5 lists the commissioner duties, and it requires the Commissioner of Health to register 2 in-state manufacturers for the production of all medical cannabis in the state. These have to be registered by December 1st, 2014. This section does allow for the commissioner to continue accepting applications should there not be a qualifying manufacturer registered in that timeline who hasn't come forward with an application. And it also requires the commissioner to register either new manufacturers or re-register existing manufacturers by December 1st of each year. As a condition of registration, we're now on page 5, line 3. So as a condition of registration, a manufacturer has to agree to begin supplying medical cannabis to patients by July 1st, 2015. The section also provides factors for the Commissioner of Health to consider when registering a manufacturer and choosing which manufacturer to register. Subdivision 2 requires the Commissioner of Health to review and publicly report on medical and scientific literature that has been published regarding the range of recommended dosages for each of the qualifying medical conditions and also a range of the chemical compositions of the plant. This needs to be published on the Department of Health website and told to the manufacturers. Moving on to page 6, Subdivision 3 provides deadlines for the Commissioner of Health. It also allows the Commissioner of Health and the manufacturer to ask for an extension of certain deadlines. If they ask the task force to extend certain deadlines, they will be extended for 1 month, or 6 months, and can only be extended one time. Section 6 requires the Commissioner of Health to adopt rules to implement these sections and allows for expedited rulemaking for certain rules. Section 7 establishes the patient registry program under this bill. The patient registry program is to evaluate data on patient demographics, effective treatment options, clinical outcomes, and quality of life outcomes for the purpose of reporting on the benefits, risks, and outcomes regarding patients with the qualifying medical condition and their engagement in the therapeutic use of medical cannabis. Under this section, the Commissioner of Health is required to give notice to healthcare practitioners in the state who are eligible to serve as healthcare practitioners under the registry program. They need to provide certain information to these healthcare providers and create certifications for the healthcare provider to use in the event that a healthcare practitioner does certify that a patient has a qualifying medical condition. This section also requires the Commissioner of Health to conduct research and studies based on the data from the health records that healthcare practitioners will be submitting to the Commissioner of Health through the registry system and publish this information in major scientific journals and give the results to the legislature as well. On page 7, line 29, there are conditions under which the commissioner may add a new delivery method or add a qualifying medical condition, and it requires the Commissioner of Health to come to the legislature with that information, and the legislature can deny the additions to those lists. Moving on to page 8. There is a patient application that every patient will need to fill out in order to become a part of the registry program. Part of the patient application is a copy of a certification from the patient's healthcare practitioner that is dated 90 days before the submission, or within the last 90 days before the submission of the application, certifying that the patient does have a qualifying medical condition. On page 8, line 30, this is for the registered designated caregiver and requires the Commissioner of Health to register one designated caregiver for a patient, as I mentioned earlier, if the patient is developmentally or physically disabled so that they are not able to self-administer medication. Subdivision 5 is for parents and legal guardians. Parents and legal guardians are separate from the registered designated caregiver but can provide care to the patient under this section. Subdivision 6 relates to patient enrollment. A patient's enrollment in the registry can only be denied if they do not have a certification from a healthcare practitioner that they do have a qualifying medical condition, if they've not signed certain disclosure forms required under this bill, if they did not provide other information required, or if they've been previously removed from the registry have provided false information. If the commissioner does deny entrance into the registry program, they need to give the patient a written reason for the denial. Moving on to page 10, the commissioner shall develop a registry verification. This registry verification happens after the commissioner has enrolled a patient in the registry program. The registry verification goes to the healthcare practitioner identified in the patient's application, to the patient, and also to the manufacturer. On page 10 is a list of information required in the registry verification. Section 8 is the healthcare practitioner duties under this bill. The healthcare practitioner, prior to a patient's enrollment in the registry program, needs to determine whether or not the patient suffers from a qualifying condition and also whether they're unable to self-administer medication and therefore in need of a registered designated caregiver, and also to advise the patients of certain information and give warnings regarding a Tennyson warning and other such information. Once a patient has been enrolled in the program, the healthcare practitioner will be notified of that enrollment and will continue to participate in the patient registry program under the guidance of the commissioner and report health records of the patient throughout the ongoing treatment for the underlying condition to the Commissioner of Health through the registry program. The healthcare practitioner is also required to determine on a yearly basis if the patient still continues to suffer from the qualifying medical condition. Section 9 is the manufacturer of medical cannabis duties. As I mentioned earlier, there is a requirement of two manufacturers within the state. Each manufacturer required to operate 4 distribution facilities. This can include the manufacturer's main location where cultivation and harvesting and packaging of the medical cannabis will take place, but it does not have to. The manufacturers shall have at least 4 locations throughout the state in which to dispense the medical cannabis.
Section
Moving on to page 12, the medical cannabis manufacturer is required to enter into a contract with the laboratory subject to the commissioner's approval. The laboratory is to test medical cannabis as to the content and for contamination and to verify that the medical cannabis meets the requirements under this section. The manufacturer has several requirements that they have to abide by in order to continue to remain registered. These include security requirements and not sharing office space with practitioners, not permitting certain employees to work for the facility, and not operating any facility within 1,000 feet of a school, and also complying with signage and marketing requirements set up by the commissioner. Subdivision 2 relates to the production of medical cannabis and requires a manufacturer to provide a reliable and ongoing supply of medical cannabis needed for the registry program. It requires the manufacturer to have all cultivation, harvesting, manufacturing, packaging, and processing of the medical cannabis to take place in a closed, locked facility. And it also requires the manufacturer to process and prepare the medical cannabis into a form that is allowed under this bill, which again is pill or liquid including oil. Subdivision 3 relates to the distribution of the medical cannabis. Medical cannabis can be distributed to a patient, to a patient's parent if the patient is under age 18, or to a patient's registered designated caregiver. Prior to distribution, the manufacturer does need to verify that they've received the registry verification from the Commissioner of Health for that individual patient, and also verify that the person requesting distribution is related to that registry verification. The manufacturer is also required to have a licensed pharmacist, at least one licensed pharmacist, on staff. The licensed pharmacist will consult with each individual patient in order to determine the proper dosage and the range of chemical compositions for that individual patient. The manufacturer is required to provide labels on any packaging released to a patient, designated caregiver, or parent, and to properly package the materials. Moving on to page 14, subdivision 4 requires each manufacturer to submit a monthly report to the Commissioner of Health. The report needs to include the amount and dosage of medical cannabis that had been distributed, the chemical composition of the medical cannabis, and the tracking number that had been assigned to any of the medical cannabis that was distributed. Section 10 is the patient duties under this bill. A patient is required to have an annual registration and pay an annual registration fee to be involved in the registry. And as a condition of continued enrollment, patients agree to continue to receive regularly scheduled treatment for their qualifying medical condition from the healthcare practitioner they identified in their application, report changes in their qualifying medical condition to their healthcare practitioner, and a patient is also required to only receive medical cannabis from a registered manufacturer, but can receive medical cannabis products from a distributor other than a registered manufacturer. Section 11 relates to the data privacy and data privacy sections of this bill. Section 12 provides for protections for involvement in the registry program. Protections include a presumption that a patient enrolled in the registry program is engaged in the authorized use of medical cannabis. Subdivision 2 is for criminal and civil protections and states that the following are not included as violations under Chapter 152 of Minnesota law. Again, these criminal protections are subject to the limitations section earlier in the bill. Use or possession of medical cannabis or products by a patient enrolled in the registry program, or possession by a registered designated caregiver or a parent or guardian of a patient under 18 are protected from criminal liability. Possession, dosage determination, or sale by either the medical cannabis manufacturer, their employees, or the laboratory conducting the testing. And also possession of medical cannabis or medical cannabis products by any person while carrying out the duties under this bill. Medical cannabis and related property are also not subject to civil forfeiture under Minnesota law. There are protections for liability with the Board of Medical Practice, the Board of Nursing, or any other professional licensing board for professionals under this bill, and also civil protections for state agencies. Moving on to page 16, subdivision 3, discrimination is also prohibited under this bill for patients based on their status as an enrolled patient in the registry program, and this includes school and landlord protection, also relating to organ transplants, and job protection in hiring and termination and condition of employment as well. Section 13 provides for new criminal liabilities and civil liabilities under the bill for intentional diversion of medical cannabis by a patient to anyone that is not involved in the registry program. On page 18, section 14 relates to nursing facilities, boarding care homes, and assisted living facilities, and allows those facilities to adopt reasonable restrictions for the use of medical cannabis for patients living in those facilities. On page 19, section 15 is for the fees collected under this bill. And the commissioner does collect an enrollment fee of $200 from patients, and again, that is an annual fee. If the patient attests to receiving Social Security disability, supplemental security insurance payments, or being enrolled in a medical assistance or Minnesota Care program, then the fee is $50 annually. A medical cannabis manufacturer is also allowed to charge patients enrolled in the registry program a reasonable fee for costs associated with the operations of the manufacturer. Section 16 is on the impact assessment of medical cannabis therapeutic research. This section establishes the Task Force on Medical Cannabis Therapeutic Research. This is a 23-member task force with the membership listed on pages 19 and 20. The task force completes several different reports, including the impact assessment listed on page 20, subdivision 2. And also the cost assessment on page 20, subdivision 3. Subdivision 4 requires the task force to issue reports to the legislature. By February 1st of 2015, a report on the design and implementation of the registry program is due to the legislature, and every 2 years thereafter, a complete impact assessment described on page 20 is due to the legislature. Upon receipt of the cost assessment from a commissioner of a state agency, the task force will also submit that report to the legislature. Section 17 is the financial examination and pricing reviews, and instructs that a medical cannabis manufacturer shall maintain detailed financial records and allows for a certified annual audit of the medical cannabis manufacturers. Section 18 adds medical cannabis as defined in Chapter 152 to the list of the exclusions from the drug formulary. Section 19 instructs the Commissioner of Health to adopt rules relating to individuals who are not authorized to possess medical cannabis under these sections and are found in possession of the medical cannabis. These rules need to establish requirements for law enforcement and healthcare professionals to report incidents involving an overdose of medical cannabis to the Commissioner of Health. Section 20 instructs the Commissioner of Health to consider the addition of intractable pain, as defined in Minnesota law, to the list of qualifying medical conditions under the under Section 152, Subdivision 14, prior to the consideration of adding any other qualifying medical conditions. Section 21 is the appropriations for the Medical Cannabis Research Act. $2,795,000 is appropriated in fiscal year 2015 from the general fund to the Commissioner of Health for the cost of administering these sections. $24,000 is appropriated to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for the purposes of the task force. And $100,000 is appropriated in fiscal year 2015 from the State Government Special Revenue Fund to the Department of Health. Section 22 is the effective date and states that sections 1 through 21 are effective the day following final enactment.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Committee, what is your pleasure? We can pause now for questions and clarifications, or we can go to public testimony. Representative Moline was wondering about the fiscal note. You do find that at your place, the high-level summary of the fiscal note the numbers were reflected in the appropriations section. There was an analysis done. So the fiscal note, the final fiscal note had been done on the House bill as passed off the House floor. They took another look at it with the changes made by the delete everything and concluded that there are no substantial changes to the fiscal note. Folks want more detail than that on the fiscal note? Seeing none. All right. Great. Questions, members, or Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the language under Section 9, manufacturer requirements section, and I think I'm reading this correctly, each manufacturer can operate up to 4 distribution facilities, but not only can, they shall. And so that should be interpreted that each manufacturer is required to have 4 distribution points. Is that a correct reading of the bill?
Senator Peterson, that is correct, yes.
One of my concerns, thank you, Mr. Chair, one of my concerns is the members go to page 6 of the critical assumptions that are built into the fiscal note. You can see that we're at an estimated monthly enrollment of just about 5,000, even 5,020. Staff has, if you read the paragraph below that, actually says that this estimate may be higher than our actual enrollment because Arizona permits cannabis to be smoked while this legislation doesn't. One of my concerns, one of my many concerns, but this is more of a practical one in terms of implementing this in the state of Minnesota, is that by way of requiring geographic distribution of dispensary points and the very low number of people that we're going to have enrolled in the program, is that we are not positioning the manufacturers and the entities that would be required to actually implement this program in an economically viable way. Not to speak to the 33,000 patients who are being left out of the bill entirely, but I'm afraid that nobody, or at least at this point, that we can guarantee that anybody is going to be served by this legislation. And I guess I'd be curious as well, to that point, what manufacturers have been able to look at this bill, given the fact, again, that the public has just seen the bill, seen the language. What manufacturers have actually given any sort of assurance that they would, in fact, be able to deal with this model and this distribution system, and particularly with the estimated number of enrollees in Minnesota? And I guess, again, getting to my more global concern, which is that this may not be a viable framework for distribution. So this is the manufacturer question.
Right.
Who has, given the fact that this hasn't been public, has a manufacturer seen this and given assurance that that this is actually viable? And then if you could expand on that a little bit, again, given the fact that we may not even have 5,000 enrollees total, and you're mandating 4 physical locations with a considerable capital expenditure and a requirement that a pharmacist be at each one of those, which aren't cheap, and I would imagine some liability, that we could even implement this, let alone a broader, more expansive system.
So to your first question, who has, which manufacturers have taken a look, this bill is not... is somewhat similar to the previous version, although of the House bill, the previous version, of course, was limited to 3. I do know that Representative Helene or some others had some contact with folks. I don't know if the change in assumptions modify how they would feel about their business prospects here in Minnesota.
Yeah. Senator Peterson, we did in the House model, which was essentially the estimate of same number of patients, a little over $5,000 estimate. We had a couple different manufacturers look at the language and were interested in and have had conversations with myself, and I know the Department of Health as well, and said that they would come to Minnesota based on that model, so the same patient load. They actually themselves wanted 2 manufacturers in the state. They thought for a healthy competition sort of aspect of it. So they felt that even though the patient estimate was around 5,000, that having 2 manufacturers would be good and having additional dispensing sites. So we have had that conversation with manufacturers in other states who looked at the House language as it came off the floor, which all factors are same or similar to the language that we have here in that regard.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Moline, Mr. Chair, one more question then. Do we have an estimated cost to start this program, not only the public expenditure but the private expenditure, in order to get this system up and running? I've heard $10 million. When you look at the private and the public expenditure, is that a fair number? Is that in the ballpark?
Senator Peterson, I just don't know. I think I've heard numbers like that. Getting started any business is significant capital effort. Typically takes some financing and takes a number of years to satisfy that financing. And I think that's what folks intend. Who would come here would expect that they would have investors or financing of some sort, and then take a number of years to, satisfy those loans and start turning the corner and seeing profitability. Do you know, Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I think it's hard to know. Offhand, we have a application price for the manufacturers, which is not that different from other states. And we've also, through our research, discovered that many states require potential manufacturers or dispensaries to post a pretty sizable bond before they are even registered or can get up to running, in the millions. So in that regard, there's, I think, less financial hurdles to set up the manufacturing under this bill. Although, I do think that we want a manufacturer that has financial stability and is able to raise capital and is able to sort of self-finance to set up just to bring, legitimacy to their business. And I think that would be beneficial and best serve patients as well to have that sort of structure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, another question sort of along the same lines of whether or not we're going to have a sustainable system here. You look at 5,000 divided by 8, you're talking about just 612 enrollees per area, but with the language of the bill requiring each manufacturer to have 4 locations, and then basing the commissioner's discretion around geography to make sure that people aren't driving 500 miles round trip, which I am afraid may still happen potentially in this bill, that you may have areas that actually have enrollment numbers, and it's a very high likelihood that you're going to have areas that have enrollment numbers that are significantly lower than 600 per distribution point or dispensary location. And given the way that the language of the bill is constructed in order to require the 4 points and no less than 4, if one of those locations sort of becomes not viable, it could potentially place the entire framework at risk, because if it's no longer profitable to operate one or two of those locations, and maybe the Minneapolis location, for example, is, it places the entire system at risk for the limited people that we've included in the bill. And so how is the commissioner, because I don't see the latitude within Section 9 particularly, the commissioner going to be able to, with that geographic mandate particularly, how is the commissioner going to make sure that each one of these locations is actually viable?
Well, it's a great question, Senator Peterson, and I really appreciate the inquiry. It's, you know, we're trying to strike a balance, of course. I think, the Senate, original Senate position was 45, came down 24.
It was a great bill, Mr. Chair. Happy to
thank you.
It.
And so we're trying to strike that balance, you know, because if this language were softer, then, you know, it's conceivable that we would have two, which would be, also equally unacceptable. So I think we really do try to, we're trying to strike that equilibrium where we create some expectations, you know, for public access to something that might be of benefit to them if they're suffering, without creating barriers of a geographic nature, and then also, you know, kind of leaving it to the manufacturers manufacturers/distributors to kind of figure out how to make it work. So, you know, your answer is somewhat your question is somewhat unanswerable at this point, but. You know, it's a struggle to try to figure out that equilibrium, that balance, get people access, remove as many barriers as we can, and see if the free market can't operate within, you know, what is, you know, a pretty not, I wouldn't say rigid, but pretty set of criteria and expectations. So. Just trying
Thank
to,
you, Mr.
trying
Chair.
To strike the balance. It may not be perfect, but those are good questions. You have a response? Great. Anything further, members? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this doesn't pertain to the bill, so if you'd enlighten me a little bit. One of the biggest caveats that I had was that we changed the name and refer to it as cannabis. And I want to thank everybody for that. I'm helping a young man who's addicted to heroin and getting him the necessary treatment. What I'd like to bring up is walking in here today, the television outside, Capital TV, still refers to it as marijuana. And so I'd just like to stress the importance and the reason why I think they should be using the terminology as cannabis as well, and just stress how frustrated I was reading that right here on Capital Television.
Thank you. It takes practice. I was using the terms interchangeably for a while at the start of the presentation of this bill at the beginning of the session, but it takes practice and discipline because the other term marijuana is distracting and gets people thinking about things that we don't want to be thinking about in this context. Thank you. So why don't we go to public testimony? We have Commissioner
Mr. Chair, just one more question. I'm looking at Section 21 now in particular. One of the things I really liked about the Senate bill, your bill, Mr. Chair, is there was no fiscal note or zero cost, I should say. This is a 2.795 appropriation in fiscal year 2015 for medical cannabis research. And I'm curious, Mr. Chair, or any of the members or staff, What are we going to glean from that research that sort of already isn't known about cannabis, given the fact that it's sort of been around for thousands of years and used and legalized in multiple states? And what are the unanswered questions sort of around medical cannabis?
Well, it's an excellent segue to call up our first testifier, the Commissioner of Health. I'll just take a stab at it, but I'll invite Commissioner Ellinger to the table to provide his prepared testimony, and maybe you can touch on. I suspect your testimony is going to touch on a response to Senator Peterson's question. You don't know what you don't know, but we do know that at least 5,000, and you know, hopefully maybe more over time, people are going to have. Their use of medical cannabis, the types, the doses, connected to their conditions and their demographic and, you know, other particular information is all going to be connected with then what's going on with them over, a fairly long period of time. All of that data is going to be collected and compiled, and the commissioner is directed to create some research study and some analysis. At a minimum, it's going to be a pretty enormous data set that a lot of researchers can go to and find out a lot more. I don't think at any point along the way that we were presenting on the Senate side that proposal, there was any dispute with the argument that we need more information. That's clear. You know, more specific information about what types of cannabis in what forms have most effect on what conditions, and the more information, the better. And this is going to be a tremendous opportunity to collect a lot of data. So that's my stab at it, and I'll welcome Commissioner Ellinger to the
committee. I'm Ed Ellinger, the Commissioner of Health, and thank you for this opportunity to be here this evening. When I first became engaged in this conversation several months ago, I stated that my goal was to try to get the powerful chemicals that are in part of the cannabis plant to patients who need those chemicals in a safe and effective way. I also identified, as has been part of this conversation just most recently, is that there is inadequate information to really make some decisions about how to use medical cannabis in the most effective way, and that for a whole variety of reasons we've not been able to have that research done, but that it's clearly evident that we need some more information. And so with that need in my role as commissioner to improve and protect the health of the people of Minnesota, I believe that the work that you have done to come to this point with this bill does all of that. It helps get medication to patients who really need it, and also allows us to gather some information which will help us to determine where to go from this point on. The registry that we are talking about has been one of the things that has been identified in every other state that has implemented a medical cannabis law, that my colleagues in other states, the commissioners of health who monitor those programs, have been really pining for information about how best to determine what dose is appropriate for what condition, what the quality of the drug for a certain condition. Are there some side effects? Where is the benefits? What are the risks? What are the problems that are developing? Even though this is not a clinical trial, this has been this patient registry has been shown to be a way to gather qualitative and subjective data on how these chemicals actually function. So over the course of the next several years, as we collect more and more of this information, we will have a lot more information to use in determining how to proceed with the other, clarifying what doses are helpful, which ones are not, where problems may come about, and where we see some real benefits. So I'm here to say thank you for the work that you've done on this. I think as I look around the country, this is probably from a medical and a public health perspective, this is the best bill that I've seen, because it does get medications to the people who really need it, but it allows us to collect some information so that we can make reasoned decisions as we move forward on how best to approve this. Certainly, I have staff with me today who have done some of the fiscal notes and have done some of the work on on the implementation, because we are committed, once this bill is signed into law, to begin immediately to start working on all of the things that need to be done to make sure that we have this up and running as rapidly as possible and really meeting the needs of the individuals who have been really vocal in trying to move this forward and the legislators, the policymakers who have really been committed to working with us and to make this the best bill possible. So with that, I'm open for any questions and comments that you have.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Questions, members? All right. Well, let me say thank you for your comments and thank you for your advice. And I know that you've spent a lot of time working with providing technical assistance as well as your staff to help out with this, as well as working with the governor and his staff. So I appreciate all the time and effort. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to give other members the opportunity to ask questions if they wanted to. Thanks for joining us, Commissioner. You had mentioned something that I wholeheartedly agree with, which is that this bill gets cannabis to people who really need it. And I think it does. I think it does get it to the people, the 5,000 people that we estimate in the bill. The Senate bill would benefit approximately 38,000, 39,000 by estimates. I guess what I'm curious about is why don't the other people really need it? Or should I say, why do these people really need it and the other ones don't? What's the difference in your opinion?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I mean, those are decisions that the policymakers will make. You know, I provide testimony and information about what we know medically, what we know public health, what we know in terms of implementing a program. Lots of discussion has occurred on the conditions that should be in place, the forms that should be used. Those are policy decisions that you're making. I'm here to give the technical advice, the scientific advice, or information, and the implementation issues that we would have as the department administering this.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that response. You said that we're the policymakers, so we're the ones that decide. But isn't it true, Commissioner Ellinger, that were it not for your administration and the governor, we would have a much more expansive bill? And that it is only because of your position, your public statements, the governor's public statements, and veto threats that we're stuck with this limited bill. And when you say things like get cannabis to people who really need it, to me that seems like a subjective statement that you're making. I think it's debatable whether or not every legislator agrees with that statement. I know the original House bill and Senate bill that passed off the floor was of the mind that there was significantly more people that really needed it. And I think it would be intellectually suspect to suggest that we're in this position for any other reason than your boss's, Governor Mark Dayton, unwillingness, frankly, to engage in a meaningful debate on the issue, and your testimony and those of your subordinates in committee. So I guess since you went so far as to say that this bill addresses those people who really need it, in your opinion, I would imagine, I guess what I'm looking for is why is it that you or the administration in general felt like the other ones didn't need it, and what's the difference between the two of them, between the two groups?
So, Commissioner, there are some elements in there that you can respond to, others maybe that...
And Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, there are, as what I'm trying to do is to get the right medicine to the right people in the right dosage at the right time. And part of, we know that we don't have enough information. With the group that we have in this bill, will allow us to do some assessment that will help us move to the next level of understanding of that. Some of the other conditions that were in there would have made it more difficult to have the kind of assessment needed to make those judgments. We also, one of my statements early on is to try to link, make sure that the treatment of these individuals who are going to be using medical cannabis are linked to their medical care provider. And these conditions here have been are things that I've talked with my medical colleagues that they are comfortable or they are willing to work with in a doctor-patient relationship the way the bill is written to move forward on these conditions so that we will be able to gather information on this. If we would had included other conditions, we may not have had the same kind of level of cooperation and understanding, and we probably would not have been able to get the kind of data that we need to make some decisions. This is, I'm sure, going to be an ongoing process as we come forward, as I come forward with new recommendations on a yearly basis of what other conditions to add. We will have a lot more information that we're going to be gathering from other states, from around the world, and from the data that we collect here.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for taking the question.
Representative Hamilton.
Chair, and I don't know if this is a question directed at either of the authors, if you could answer this, or if the commissioner can. And I've had, since appointed to this committee, had a few inquiries about the veterans and, you know, the post-traumatic stress and stuff like that. And I'm hoping that we can be open to the idea and work together to see if we need to be more, encompassing. And I think it's going down the same line of thought process that you are, Senator, as well. And I think it's also important to know that I went from absolutely opposed to this coming into this legislative session to serving on this conference committee. And so, again, the other areas that where there may be a need or an interest, I wonder if there's language in here. Again, help me out to address that as well.
Representative Hamilton, and I'll just say for the record, I too think it's regrettable that folks who might be able to benefit from medical cannabis aren't captured in this proposal. There is the opportunity to consider expanding the list, and that starts with, of course, the definition of qualifying medical condition. Which is item number 10 of subdivision 14, line 3.24, any other medical condition or its treatment approved by the commissioner, then a process is provided for that consideration. Of course, we do have an already acknowledged intractable pain not connected to a particular diagnosis is the first thing for the commissioner to consider on that section 20. Back on page 23, in a little process set forth, working in conjunction with the task force. The task force plays a role as well. And then you know where the process is set forth, too. As well, Representative Hamilton, methods or of consuming medical cannabis or the forms of medical cannabis also could be added to the list. And then the process set forth of consideration and adding to the list. Okay, so that's on page 7, starting on line 29. Paragraph B, if the commissioner wishes to add a delivery method or a qualifying medical condition, there's a process of notifying the legislature, receiving comments from the public, guidance from the task force, and then some time standards are set forth for the decision to be made kind of at the beginning of a legislative session, allowing a legislative session to pass, giving the legislature the opportunity to act. And if they don't act, then either the form and method of delivery or the condition is added to the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I just wanted to talk a little bit in response to the questions. And, this is, for me, like so many people, a question, an evolving question, although I have, supported, been voted for medical marijuana at least twice since I've been elected in a broader bill. At first, I think, very skeptical about the idea of engaging in some sort of clinical trial. When that idea was first proposed by the administration, but feel fairly strongly about, in fact, quite strongly about the idea of a patient registry, because I do think that as we are making that transition from our own perspectives about marijuana to the idea of putting into law medical cannabis in Minnesota, I think we are joining other states and other countries that are on that edge of inquiry and learning about the preparations that are going to be available to people and how they interact, how those chemicals interact with a person's condition, disease. And I think if we agree that the compounds in the whole plant extracts have a powerful chemical effect on a person's condition, if we agree on that, then I think it's important that we also agree that we should understand that to the best of our ability. And while it would have been, I think, awesome for us in Minnesota to proceed with a full clinical trial, the thought of conducting that from a state legislature, putting that into policy, passing a bill, affording that, while we're not the experts, allowing places like the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic lead that charge for us, I think it was a very ambitious goal. So I think moving forward with the idea of a registry to do that observational research was something that really earned support of a number of, I think, members who were not inclined to support this proposal in the House, which I think is important. I think it has earned the attention of the medical community in a way that I think gives this and that thus Minnesotans who are skeptical some confidence in what we're doing. And I do think it's going to help us learn going forward. I would love it if we could include everybody. I think also, like Senator Dibble and probably everybody at this table, find it the challenge of the environment in which we work and the decisions that we have to make. But going forward, I think we're going to be in stronger position if we take this step first, if we build upon a solid foundation of not only taking what we've learned from other states, from what other countries are already doing, and we, there certainly is clinical trial going on in other parts of the world that we can learn from, but also then to build upon what we're able to learn by taking a first solid foundational step and then building on that. And I have all the confidence in the world. I really do have confidence that on this foundation we will have a better understanding of how these chemicals work with various conditions, and with that confidence can come back and look at other issues and other conditions and see how we build on this foundation for people in Minnesota, and not only serve the Minnesotans that are interested in this well, but also contribute to both the science and the knowledge and the treatment of people in other parts of the country. So while I agree with your concern about the number of people, I also think that we are taking an important step in terms of understanding the science underneath this, and it's going to impact people in the future in Minnesota, and I think that's important as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding Section 12, and I'm not certain that the Commissioner, Commissioner Ellinger, at least, would speak to the criminal justice-related questions. One of the questions that I have would be a patient that possesses medical cannabis and maybe is involved in a traffic stop or some other sort of stop by law enforcement. It doesn't seem to me anywhere in the bill that would require that the law enforcement officer at least establish whether or not the person is a medical cannabis patient or registered patient before they conduct a probable cause search of that individual's person or their vehicle, for example. you know, going with my example, you're pulled over, you have they see something suspicious, maybe it's a vaping device, mm-hmm. and there's hash oil in it. And upon that basis, the law enforcement officer uses that as probable cause to search the vehicle before ever doing sort of the due diligence that's required, I suppose, under this statute, which says that some people can legally do it and therefore probably shouldn't be a probable cause or justify the establishment of probable cause. I'm just curious what we're doing in the bill to make sure that people aren't illegally searched or having their sort of rights violated as a result of being in possession of medical cannabis.
I will ask counsel to help me answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, there is some protection on page 16, line 22, that states that the possession of a registry verification, which the patient is given from the commissioner, or an application for enrollment into the registry alone does not constitute probable cause in that situation. There are also places throughout the bill and in current law that say that you cannot be vaping medical cannabis in a vehicle, while driving a vehicle.
Of course. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I do see that, and I saw that in the bill, that possessing a registration card does not constitute probable cause by itself. But that still doesn't mean that if somebody, for some reason, a law enforcement officer sees that you're in possession, for some reason, of cannabis of any form, that would not, given the fact that we don't specifically enumerate that in the bill, that would not establish probable cause in the mind of that officer, and therefore result in a broader search of that individual's person or vehicle, for example, or home, for that matter.
So, Senator Peterson, there's a couple of things I think that might. We don't have the card, the registry card, as we did in the Senate proposal. So someone wouldn't have a card they could just show the commissioner, the police officer. We do have folks who are on the registry list, and that list would be, I think, probably fairly easy to verify. Also, when folks have medical cannabis in their possession, it'd be in a container that's labeled with the number of identifiers, including their name and the fact that this is medical cannabis for medical purposes and the like. So that, is something that is a way to communicate to the officer. It's not specifically spelled out or called for, I don't think, in the bill. For folks to carry something with them that shows their status, like a piece of paper or something, as a patient on the registry, but they probably should for that reason. The same challenge, of course, is true no matter what in every state, and there are ways. So it's hard to stop an officer from conducting at least the initial inquiry, but then there are various remedies for at least demonstrating fairly early on, as the officer starts to wonder what's going on, to say, hey, this is cool, it's medical cannabis, it's in the right kind of canister with the right notifications, here's my piece of paper.
Sure.
And hopefully the commissioner will help folks figure that out, and we have the task force with law enforcement, and I know other states have developed guidance documents to local law enforcement for how to respond to when they think they have probable cause, figure out pretty quickly if they don't, that this is perfectly fine to just stop. I've seen some of those documents from other states.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It'd be safe to say, though, that there's really no, under this bill, there's really no way to prevent that, or no requirement of law enforcement, for example, to at least ask if that is something that they're presented with before maybe proceeding.
Senator Peterson, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, the scenario that you raise, the only circumstance I could see would be a search subsequent to arrest, in which probable cause for arrest would have had to have been established, and then there's could be a search subsequent to arrest in which, you know, if medical cannabis is found, as Senator Dibble pointed out, we already have all the identifying features required on the label. And so if that is the person that's in possession of it, you know, I don't foresee that they would be able to face any criminal charges for possessing it. Just as right now, if you were arrested and there was a search subsequent to arrest and an officer found a prescription bottle on you, if you are that person who's on the prescription bottle, then you certainly aren't in any unlawful possession of any sort of controlled substance, which I think would be the same circumstance here. So there are a number of protections in the bill, I think, that would address that issue exactly that you raised. So, you know, I don't see any concerns myself in that regard.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't stay on this forever. I do hope it's something that we dig into with the task force. I don't think that's 100% the case, Representative Moline. I do believe that the reason or the threshold that needs to be reached in order to be stopped by a peace officer is reasonable suspicion, not probable cause. And so I do think there are scenarios that that in fact you could be subject to a search if it becomes known that you're possessing cannabis and the individual hasn't established that you are lawfully carrying it. But I just for the record, I think that there is some gray area, obviously, in this area of the bill. That's all I have on this, though, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, I mean, just for clarity purposes, so the standard for a traffic stop would be reasonable, articulable suspicion, which doesn't quite rise to the level of probable cause, but in order to search a suspect, it has to rise to the level of probable cause.
In possession of a controlled substance would be, Mr. Chair, would establish probable cause if you weren't aware that that individual was illegal medical cannabis.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, you wouldn't know that they were in possession of a controlled substance or medical cannabis without the search, which had to first be established by probable cause through an arrest. But we can
I think there is a scenario
like
where
a
we could, but I'll leave it alone for now.
Very good. Anything further, Commissioner?
Nope.
All right. Anything further, members, for the Commissioner? All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
All right. Anything further, members, before we go to public testimony? All right. Very good. So, where did you have the list? Give it to me.
Just if people want to testify,
they can come up. All right. So now we will take a public testimony. So if anyone would like to come to the table and share some thoughts and ideas with us, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Angie Weaver. You may also have seen my daughter Amelia and my husband Josh, but she's had a long day, so she had to run out. They may run back in, though. We also have a 3-year-old Penelope who's at home with Grandma. Oh, there they come. I'd like to tell you briefly about my daughter Amelia. Amelia was born a beautiful, healthy baby girl. The first 2.5 years of her life were like a dream come true. She was walking, talking, feeding herself, singing her ABCs, counting to 20. We thought she was, like, the smartest kid in the world, like most parents. When she was 2.5, we found her one morning having a seizure in her crib. We don't know how long she'd been seizing for. It's the scariest moment of my life, watching my baby have a seizure. By the time we got her to the hospital, she had 4 more before they sedated her. I can't describe how helpless it is to watch your child suffer and to not be able to do anything to stop it. Amelia has tried 23 anticonvulsants. She has failed every one of them. In her short life, she's had well over 1,000 seizures. She has side effects from these anticonvulsants, brittle bones, and when she breaks a bone, it's serious and requires surgeries, liver damage. some of the side effects we're currently dealing with, because getting into the list of all the others would be take forever, sleeplessness, excitability, nausea, vomiting. My husband and I joked, wouldn't it be great if something could help with nausea from all these seizure meds? Amelia has been diagnosed with Dravet syndrome. It's a rare catastrophic form of epilepsy. It's hard to treat. There's few treatment options. We've already failed 23 meds in the special diet. The kind of people that my husband and I are those that refuse to believe that this is going to be our daughter's life. When we got this diagnosis, we immediately started researching, what are other parents of kids with Dravet syndrome doing? Because I bet they're just not watching their kids suffer and pass away. We came across a video of a little girl named Charlotte Figge, and we watched her with our daughter's same diagnosis take a dropper full of medical cannabis. And Charlotte, who is having more seizures than our daughter, almost 300 a day or week, she started walking and talking again and having seizure control and quality of life. When I watched this video, I said to my husband, we have to get this for Amelia. She needs this. Since age 4, Amelia's lost the ability to speak. She's regressed developmentally, is now globally delayed. She needs help in all aspects of her life, all of her self-care. I stay home to take care of her full-time. She has 30 to 50 seizures a day. While she's able to walk, she has to be strapped into a chair or held by my husband and I at all times, because otherwise she risks falling over and breaking bones, risking serious injury. Can't tell you what it meant today to call my mom and tell her that we got to stay in Minnesota, that we don't have to move away from our family, that my 3-year-old Amelia's sister gets to stay with her Nana and Papa and grandparents and uncles and aunts and cousins. This is going to help my daughter Amelia and children with epilepsy and thousands of people in Minnesota. We're so grateful for everyone that's been involved in making this happen for us. This is going to change our daughter's life, and it's a very important first step for Minnesota. I thank everyone involved that has made this happen, because it has not been an easy process. We have been at this. We've given our lives. We have given our time. We've driven the 8-hour round trip to the Capitol more times than I can count. This is important. I don't want my daughter to be one of the children that passes away while we're waiting for a medical marijuana law. Amelia needs and deserves this, as do all the people suffering in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weaver. And let me thank you publicly for all of your time and efforts. I think Representative Mullane said some of the families have been here more than we have this year. So it's hard work, but it takes citizen engagement. So we appreciate that so much. Questions, members? All right. Thank you so much. I found my list. I have Christy Pauling had indicated a desire to come.
Do you want me to move a chair?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start when you're.
Hello, committee members. My name is Christy Pauling. Along with me is my husband Jeremy and my daughter Caitlin. Caitlin is 7 years old. Her sisters Kaylee, 12, and Cassie, 10, could not be here today. Caitlin has Batten's disease with intractable epilepsy. She started out as a healthy little girl. She was my climber. She was into everything. Couldn't keep her off the top of the table. At 3 years of age, her seizures kept coming and coming. We tried lots of medications. Nothing seemed to help. The medications that she was taking had warnings, and she still takes them, warnings of liver damage, kidney damage, and loss of eyesight, and they were FDA approved. We feel medical cannabis would be a safer option for her. She was regressing and losing all of her milestones that she had mastered. We sought out specialist after specialist to figure out what was happening. She had a stem cell transplant with little improvement. At 5 years of age, we finally got diagnosed with Batten's disease, nothing a parent ever wants to hear. It is a terminal disease, and she is expected to live to 10 to 12 years of age. She cannot walk, she cannot talk, and cannot eat only through her G-tube. She is wheelchair-bound. Her days continue to get worse with seizures, movements, and loss of eyesight. Nothing is working. There is no cure for her disease. The hard part of this is telling her older sisters that she is going to die. We are hoping that with medical cannabis, we can give her a better quality of life for the years that she has left and maybe prolong her life so a cure can be found. We are out of options, and the only thing left is hope. We appreciate you working hard to get a workable bill that hopefully the governor will agree with. We know it was hard for a lot of you to make the decisions that you have. This is a stepping stone in the right direction to figure out what others need. We know medical cannabis is working for other children in other states to help reduce their seizures and give them a better quality of life. With this bill, we can stay in the state we love and be with our support system. Caitlin can be with her sisters, and our family can stay as one. Thanks for taking time to listen to my testimony and giving us hope for the future.
Thank you, Ms. Pauling. Mr. Pauling, did you want to speak?
Yes, my name is Jeremy Pauling. Thank you, committee members, for having me here today. I was asked to talk on behalf of Maria Boddicker and Mark Boddicker from Clinton. Martha was going to be here today, but she had to run to another meeting. Here we go. I'm here to testify today about a little girl named Greta, 7 years old. Maria and Greta have been living in Colorado legally to access Charlotte's Web in a safe, legal liquid form of medical cannabis that Greta takes mixed with her food 3 times a day. This medical cannabis has been such a miracle for Greta, but since it's not legal in the state of Minnesota, so their family had to make the tough decision of move Greta and Maria to Colorado while Greta's father Mark and two older sisters, Emma and Laura, it is 13 and 10, continue to live at home on their farm in Clinton, Minnesota. Greta started seizing at 5 months of age. She was diagnosed with infantile spasms at 7 months, and her condition has further deteriorated into Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, which is a severe form of epilepsy in which Greta has to endure multiple types of seizures each day and also have severe development delay. Mark and Maria have done everything they possibly can to help control Greta's epilepsy over the last 7 years. To date, Greta has failed over 15 different epilepsy medications, 2 strict, specialized diets, and even brain surgery. This past summer, after much research and prayer, Mark and Maria, Emma, and Laura decided that moving part of their family to Colorado was necessary to give Greta her greatest shot at seizure freedom. Greta's longtime epilepsy physician from St. Paul even supported them, going to Colorado as he knew that Greta had run out of options to treat her epilepsy. So they went to Colorado, purchased a home there, went through the rigorous process of getting Greta approved for medical cannabis, and finally were able to start Charlotte's Web on November 12, 2013. Since starting the medical cannabis, Greta has enjoyed a nearly 80% decrease in her seizure activity and has been able to get off 4 of her 5 pharmaceutical medications she was taking, and most importantly, she started doing things she has never done before, such as being able to hold a spoon and bring it to her mouth. Maria also just recently noticed how she really enjoys looking around at the world when they are outside in a stroller or out for a drive. In the past, Greta would just keep her head down and not really engage in the environment around her at all. But now, a school bus drives by when you're out for a stroller ride, it has Greta pointing and smiling. We're all really excited that Greta recently started giving kisses again. Maria is sure that it has been well over 4 years since Greta used to give her out kisses this way. Those daily seizures are just so devastating to Greta's overall growth, development, safety, and health and happiness, and now medical cannabis is helping control them and therefore allowing Greta to learn again. This is just a part of the reason that Mark and Maria and their family have been determined to get cannabis legalized in Minnesota. There are so many children and adults that can benefit from the plant and all of its components. The medical cannabis that Greta is taking in Colorado does not and would never give anyone a high because of the extremely low amount of THC in the cannabis she takes. It's safer than any of the prescription medications she has been on over 7 years, but they can't legally bring it home or even bring Greta home for a short visit. The best medical treatment for Greta has ever had, and it's illegal in our state. Now that Mark and Maria have seen the impressive medical cannabis results with Greta, all their family really wants to do is be together again. Living in Clinton, with the ability to treat Greta with medical cannabis here in Minnesota, they want for all families that are in the similar situation. Greta absolutely adores being with her family, especially her sisters, and this is something that she has been only with them for 20 days out of the last 184 days and has been from home. Maria and Greta are not separated. Maria and Greta are not only separated from Mark, Emma, and Laura, but also away from grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, and lots of friends back in the community. Please help bring Greta and Maria back home by legalizing medical cannabis in Minnesota this session. We just want them home soon and for Greta to be able to have access to a quality form of cannabis in Minnesota as soon as possible. Thank you so much for your time you have put into working on this issue. We need something functional past this session. And Mark and Maria and our entire family are grateful for your wisdom, perseverance, and mostly your compassion. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pauling. Please tell the Boddickers bring them our greetings and like the Weavers and yourselves, I echo again the thanks for your incredible diligence and stamina on behalf of yourselves, but of course on behalf of many, many, many other people.
And we appreciate you guys sitting down and listening to what we had to say. I don't know how many people we've talked through the House and Senate, and they didn't know where they were at, and just listening to us and becoming educated by what we had known. We've probably learned more about this in the past year and a half than a lot of people. So we appreciate that also.
Great. Well, you've moved mountains, so we appreciate it. Questions? Anything, members? Thank you. All right. Do we have other testifiers who'd like to come forward? Welcome.
All right. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Cassie Tron. I'm 24 years old, and I've had severe refractory Crohn's disease for the past 8 years. In the first 3 years of my illness, I failed nearly all conventional treatments, three of which carry FDA black box warnings, and one that actually requires patients enroll in a federal monitoring program because the side effects are so severe. In the 5 years since, not one new medication has been approved by the FDA for Crohn's disease. 5 years ago, during a flare that left me unable to keep down solid foods for 18 days, I tried cannabis and could finally eat again. I continued to use cannabis daily, and I am now very pleased to say I've been in remission for 5 years. I take zero pharmaceuticals for Crohn's disease. My doctor is fully supportive of my current treatment plan, which includes vaporizing plant material. Whole plant cannabis treats my disease, not just my symptoms. I'm completely unsure whether or not using solely oils will keep me in remission like whole plant does. So my choices now are to use a form of cannabis that may or may not work, or to remain a criminal to access the type of cannabis that I know works for me. High-potency oil can be extremely intoxicating. This defeats the purpose of self-titration and can render patients completely incapacitated. Finally, something I find particularly vexing about the exclusion of whole plant is that the conversation around this issue has included the desire to get out of the way of patients and doctors in order for them to make the best medical decisions together. While I look forward to other patients being able to discuss the benefits of medical cannabis with their doctors, and I sincerely hope they find relief, I want to be clear that by forcing me to use a high-potency oil, this bill is actually wedging itself in between my doctor and I and the treatment plan that I am currently using and he approves of. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tron. We did include what we call whole plant extracts, and that does not require it's not required to be a high-potency oil. Does that leave you any options that are better than just high-potency oils?
I actually need quite a bit of THC. That's what's been keeping me in remission. And so I would need these high-potency oils, which, again, are extremely intoxicating. I have passed out from using them currently. So that, I mean, again, not as serious side effects as we've seen, but passing out isn't exactly a functional way to use medicine.
Okay. Questions, members? Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Appreciate your testimony. It's important for us to hear it. Ms. Whiting. Joni Whiting. Welcome.
Good afternoon, everybody. In 2009, I came before, started coming before committees and talking about my daughter that died of melanoma skin cancer.
Ms. Whiting, can you just introduce yourself quickly for the
My name is Joni Whiting, and I'm from Jordan, Minnesota. In 2009, I was asked by my legislative House representative to come before committees and to tell them the story of my daughter, and I did that. My daughter illegally used cannabis in the last 89 days of her life. And some of you, I think most of you, I have sat and testified in front of. I am neutral on this bill. I am so glad that there is going to be a bill passed that helps these children that you see here. But I also know of a little boy that I talked to his mother, who is in this group of parents, whose little boy doesn't qualify under this bill because he has mitochondrial disease. His mother came down here this whole session, and she kept telling the sitter, or telling her little boy, it's okay, it's okay. Mommy's going to go get the medicine to make your throw-ups stop, because he has severe nausea and he can't swallow water, food, or his medicine. And when I leave here, I'm going to have to go back and call her and tell her that she's not included and that her son is not included on this. He doesn't have any of the things that help him to get the medicine. So I would ask, first of all, that you reconsider, because there are two children in this same group of people that have been coming down here and hoping and praying that that five-year-old little boy is helped by this oil and that his mommy did get him the medicine to make his throw-ups go away. The only thing I have to say is that my daughter has already passed away, and I have no personal agenda here other than to tell what happened to my daughter. But as a mother, and I've done extensive research since she's passed, and I can tell you that if I had a choice between continuing to have my daughter illegally smoke 1 to 2 puffs of plant material marijuana locked in a small bathroom in our house and be able to come out and eat is more preferable, even with the legal ramifications, than what my daughter would get from this bill from you. In other words, I would tell my daughter to continue to illegally use marijuana rather than get on this program. And that is only because, as a mother, and I have researched this, I do believe that when you take the plant and you alter it and you take I think it's a pound of marijuana makes 2 ounces of extract, you're taking someone that could have used 1 to 2 tiny puffs of plant material, a pinch, and now you've subjected them into 10 to 16 times more than they needed of psychoactive THC material. And I would be worried about that. I'm very, very concerned about that. So I thank you for having me here. And God bless you all for everything that you've done, and especially you that changed your mind and are helping people and these moms. But I'll be back to see you guys again until it's done all the way. Thank you so much for beginning this. But it wouldn't have helped us. And my daughter was a cancer patient, and she is listed on that bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whiting. Questions for Ms. Whiting?
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate again, all of your diligence as well.
Thank you.
Kim Kelsey.
Hi, my name is Kim Kelsey, and I'm from Excelsior, Minnesota. I typically dress a little bit more capital-ish. but today, we were at a very cool thing. We had a press conference with Coach Jerry Kill from the Gophers for Epilepsy Awareness Day in Minnesota. So we were at Kieran's, and then we were all going to the Twins game, and then I got the call. They went to the Twins game. I came here. So I don't have my, I have it a little bit on my phone. If you allow me to share Alex's story, or if all of you have heard it before, I could not say it too, but I just think it's important, if that's okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. And it's much smaller on my phone than it was on the iPad. Okay. I live in Excelsior with my husband Mark and daughter Morgan and son Alec. We are in total support of medical cannabis for Alec and also the thousands of Minnesotans with intractable epilepsy and other ailments. Intractable seizures is when multiple drugs have been tried and failed to control somebody's seizures. It was the morning of Mother's Day, May 12, 1996, which was just 18 years ago, that we woke to find Alec in his bed, unconscious, barely clinging to life. EMTs performed CPR, intubated him in our kitchen, and he was airlifted to the hospital, where he spent 18 days in a coma and the next 6 months in the hospital. Assuming that Alec would live and wake from the coma, he was rated at best to be in a vegetative state for the rest of his life. Well, Alec did wake up from the coma, and he went on to defy all of the odds, which he continues to do daily. He had to relearn all of the basic things like eating, talking, walking, etc. We got him back, and that was our miracle number one. The formal diagnosis was encephalitis. It was a high fever that caused him to have a seizure in the middle of the night and aspirated, leaving him deprived of oxygen for an unknown period of time. The result was bilateral brain damage, which led to what has now been an 18-year battle with daily life-threatening seizures. Initially, we were told that it could take up to 2 years to find the right medication. 18 years and 24 anticonvulsants later, Alec's seizures remain uncontrolled. Today, a combination of 5 drugs and 32 pills a day don't stop the hundreds of seizures that he has daily. To put it into more perspective, a leading Minnesota neurologist recently told us that for any patient that is exhausted as many meds as Alec and remains uncontrolled, the likelihood of a new pharmaceutical working is less than 3%. Alec's seizures are life-threatening, so my husband and I are with him 24/7. And when I say 24/7, I mean 24/7. He is 6 feet 2 inches tall, 175 pounds, that is physically capable, but cannot be left alone. My husband sleeps with him, must be in the shower with him, and is under our supervision at all times. We carry an emergency medication called Diastat, which must be delivered rectally to stop a seizure that could take his life at any given moment. Imagine me being in the aisle at Target trying to administer this medication to a life and death situation, and I've done it. He's considered high risk for SUDEP, which is sudden unexplained death in epilepsy. This puts him at risk of death even when he is not seizing. He's been around the country for, we have been around the country for every conceivable test to determine if there was a surgical condition, but this was ruled out. That is the negative side of the story, but Alec won't let us look at it like that. People ask us all the time, how do you cope with it all? And our response is, Alec is the one walking around, playing sports, what have you, not knowing when he might have a seizure, and it does. If it doesn't bother him, what right do we have to complain? We can only make things better. He has shown us what it means to be, to persevere. From the beginning, not only did he not complain, he found a way to make the best of it. He was the winning kid at age 9 for the Epilepsy Foundation of Minnesota and throwing out the first pitch at a Twins game. He was born an athlete and has ferociously competitive spirit. This is how he beat the odds then and why he lives for sports now. Today he competes with our Special Olympics delegation, the West Metro Warriors, that we started for him in 2007 to ensure he would have a competitive outlet. He is a leader in our delegation that has grown to support more than 75 athletes and families. He also does Global Messenger for Special Olympics and is very involved in doing speeches. Not on a little iPhone like me. Mm. Oh gosh, it flipped. when Alec was little, he would have a seizure on the ice during a hockey game, and my husband would carry him off the ice to a bench. First thing out of Alec's mouth when he regained consciousness was, "Dad, don't let me miss my shift." This happens more often than not. He refuses to give up. He will fight when most people would sleep for anywhere from 3 to 24 hours after a tonic-clonic seizure. He's up and at him trying to get his legs back so he can get back in the game and finish it. I'm kind of skipping ahead because you guys have all been here a long time. And let's see. Oh, I got to the thank you page. And so I'll just expand on that. So I want to thank you guys so much for all your hard work. I can't believe that. The hours that we've been here and all the people that we've met and the big hearts, even though this is politics, and everyone that I know was like, why are you getting involved? You can't fight City Hall. You can't this. But you know what? We found out that we can and that you guys truly, truly care about all patients. And I truly believe that with what happened today is the first step in the right direction. I mean, I'm so speechless, which all of you in here know I'm not very speechless about anything, but I'm so excited that so many people will have access to try this, and it's all the hope that a lot of us have, but I just look forward to seeing the rest of Minnesota patients being able to have access to this, particularly the one that, I guess, the people that are suffering that may not be considered terminal. I don't know if terminal means 4 weeks or what exactly the interpretation of terminal is, but if there's a way to get it to those patients before they become terminal. So I just thank you, and I look forward to seeing you again, and I truly, if this works for Alec and the rest of the patients that are included in this bill, we'll all be back here together as a group to say miracle number 2. So thank you. All
right. Well, thank you, Ms. Kelsey, and thank you for bringing Alec by a few days ago. I got to meet him outside the chambers. That was great. He's a great guy.
He keeps wondering why I keep going to the Capitol to see Bill. Bill is our pharmacist. So I'll say, well, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to work on the bill. He's like, I don't get it. Every time we go see Bill, he just gives us our medicine. So...
Great. Yeah, he was.
I got to find somebody named Bill in the Capitol.
So,
thank you. Any questions?
Questions, members. All right.
And the Twins won, I heard.
All right. Excellent. Good omen. Mary Beth Davidson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't usually get nervous, but when it's about my son, I do.
I'm here as a mom, Mary Beth Davidson, and thank you so much. I have a son who is 27 and has about 1,000 seizures a day. And I was talking to the Christopher Valve, and I should stop crying, but there is a little issue here in the bill. Under some on page 8, subdivision 4, registered designated caregiver. Normally, I wouldn't be testifying on this bill, but you know, as a mom who has the potential of maybe using this new therapy, I'm really excited. My son has Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. It's a rare seizure disorder with intractable seizures, about 1,000 seizures a day. Lives in a group home with another child who has the same diagnosis. The program manager from the home was a lab tech at Mayo. She's very good with his meds, very good with seizures, and this would prohibit her from treating two children in the same or two clients in the same group home. And I don't know how you'd get around that if there's two people with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. They both have intractable seizures. Both parents want to try this therapy. We could run into problems. So I just wanted to say thank you so much. Sorry to get emotional. I'm doing this for Mike's dad, too, Tony Mancuso, who's written articles and is really interested in trying this therapy. Thank you.
Thank you.
So just to put it on the record that it could be a problem, because sometimes they combine these kids into one group home and take them out of the group home every other weekend and would then be, I suppose, that caregiver as well that would be responsible for this. Right now we have to sign off for the 5 meds that he's on. And just FYI, it takes lactulose 4 times a day to draw the ammonia out of his liver because the other drugs are killing his liver. So we're really excited about trying.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Davidson? Thank you. Well, we do contemplate, one patient can have, one patient can have one more than one caregiver, but the reverse is not the case. So I don't know. We talked a little bit about it this afternoon, but didn't land on a fix. The other issue around caregivers, members, is, well, we'll get into that in just a second.
One patient. Yeah.
They could have one patient that was in the same residence. Right. Okay. All right. We'll get counsel to think about this subject for a minute. And Representative Hamilton.
Ms. Chairman, I'd just like to say she brings up an excellent point, like many people have, and I was wondering if we couldn't do some type of oral amendment to address that.
Yes, but first, I have another idea, too, that I wanted to run past the committee. It has to do with the caregiver issue as well. But so why don't we let Ms. Kavanagh think about it, and why don't I call for more public testimony? And would anyone else like to testify? Ms. Kelsey wants to say something. She didn't finish her thoughts.
I know. Shocker. It's Kim Kelsey again. That brought up an interesting fact, and I'm not sure because I haven't read exactly what it says, but with the caregiver situation like ours, theirs is different because of the group home, and that makes total sense because a few of Alex's friends are in group homes. In our case, we don't have a nurse or anybody. It's my husband or myself. Mm-hmm. And so if
you can both act. There's no prohibition on one person having more than one caregiver. The issue we're trying to address is one caregiver having more than one patient.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify that. What?
And then the other issue, but we'll get to it. And again, I'm going to want to start crossing my issues here. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. We'll take just a moment to see if we can't resolve that with a quick oral amendment. Then the other one is about book itself administered by Can Drive.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Senator Laurie.
I keep hearing you say that they can have, that an individual patient could have multiple designated caregivers, and that's not how I read this either. On line 830 and 831, the commissioner shall register a single designated caregiver under certain circumstances, and I see that as a limitation on the number of caregivers for an individual patient, too, I'm missing something, if I could get.
Where are you looking, Senator Lord?
Line 8.30 and 8.31.
Oh, we did button that up.
Mr. Chair, I might be able to provide some clarification. Right. I think that that's right, that there is one single designated caregiver for one patient, but that's referring to the registered designated caregivers. Parents of a patient under age 18, I should say, are separate from the registered designated caregivers and are not lumped into that same qualification.
Without having to register.
That's also.
Yeah, that is correct, Senator Lurie.
I see that. Thank you.
All right. We might need to unravel this just a little bit. Senator Lurie.
Well, if you have, as I read the parent or legal guardian exemption, I mean, I do know that some of these families actually have, loved ones that are over the age of 18, and that parent or legal guardian is only for parents of a child under the age of 18. So, I mean, you could have some of these family situations that are quite severely limited here. I don't know if there's a willingness amongst the conference committee
to
work on that. I mean, because as soon as your child hits 18, then you fall out of the parent or legal guardian protection, where you don't have to be registered, and then you got to go over to the registered side, and then only one of the parents that are providing constant care.
Okay. Well, let's first deal with the person who needs.
One caregiver
with more than one. Yeah, the people who need who maybe rely on the same person. So we'll deal with the reverse issue first. And Ms. Kavanagh has a suggestion.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, on page 9, line 7, before the period, insert unless the patients reside in the same residence. So the person will not. Person will not be registered designated caregiver for more than one patient unless the patients reside in the same residence. I believe there might be other places in the bill that we would have to add that, and you could give us the authority to find those places and add that same
in the final
idea. Yeah, right. Okay. Places that need to be added in the bill.
Okay. Members, what do you think of that idea? Senator Lurie.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. I think the paragraph number 2 right above that on line 9.2 and 9.3 also might be a limiting factor as well, because the person trying to register can't be registered as a designated caregiver for another patient enrolled. In fact, I mean, paragraph 2 and 4 seem quite duplicative to me. And if we just fix 4 without fixing 2, I don't think we've actually fixed it and allowed a registered designated caregiver to provide care for 2 patients living in that group home situation that was mentioned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, I do think that number two is slightly different than number four.
Yes.
Just saying that the designated caregiver prior to enrollment and then after enrollment for number four, but that would definitely be one of the places that Senate Council and I would work on in order to make the new unless the patients reside in the same residence language work throughout the bill. If that was a concept that the committee were to adopt, we would make sure that that language worked okay throughout the bill.
Representative Murphy.
Somebody who's in an assisted living or nursing facility. Residents apply.
Mr. Chair, I believe so. A group home at Wood, nursing home at Wood. What was your other one? An institution? It depends. Okay. Yes, I would.
Yeah. Okay.
We will make sure, but I believe it would.
All right. So why don't we move? Someone needs to move the language on line 9.3 and on 9.7, unless the patients reside in the same residence.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Right. And we'll just incorporate into this motion, but we'll also do kind of a comprehensive motion at the end that council is directed to find all the places in the bill to include the same concept. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Davidson. Did we need to deal with the other issue first that Senator Roy raised? So the parents or legal guardians issue, just by way of background and context, was to make sure that we are providing, the original thought came about because of kids, and it was a gap in our review of the bill over the last couple of days. And so that's how this language landed in there. But Senator Lawyer, you raised a good point about patients who have legal guardians who are above 18. I'll ask counsel, is there anything magic about under 18 in those instances when folks have parents or legal guardians who continue to take care of them? Can we just strike that language, or do we need to do something a little more to address that circumstance?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Molina,
I think that they would then be able to apply to become the registered caregiver, and the registered caregiver can only have one patient, but the patient can have more than one registered caregiver. And so I think both parents, once they reach the age of majority, could become the registered caregiver. They would be subject to the restrictions that are part of the registered caregiver provisions, but my understanding is that they would still be able to be a registered caregiver.
They would, Representative Boleyn, other than they'd be subject to all the caregiver, kind of the more traditional caregiver requirements, background check, et cetera.
A point of clarification, Mr. Chair, I do think that there might be some problem with the language if you did want a patient to have more than one designated caregiver. Page 8, line 31 does say that the commissioner shall register a single designated caregiver for a patient.
Right. In what instances, right, so yeah, I had made a statement before that was completely false because we do have the single designated caregiver. It was true at one time, I'm sure. I think something changed along the way. So how does the committee want to proceed? Representative Hamilton.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think if we just would strike under age 18, that could potentially accomplish what it is that the senator is trying to address as well.
Yeah. Would that work?
Mr. Chair, I do think that that would work. It would be allowing the parent or legal guardian of any patient that ability. So if that is the committee's intent, I think that that would work.
Okay. And then would that, and that would then allow them to have more than one caregiver? Because, you know, there can well be more than one parent.
Yes, because they wouldn't be designated.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, okay. It would. Okay. It would also allow parents of any patient to pick up the medication and mm-hmm. all of the things throughout the bill.
Okay, very good. All right, so would someone like to move motion to strike under age 18 on lines 9.12 and 13?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right.
16 and 17.
And do we need to do the same under 16 and 17?
There might be a few places.
We would need to do so in multiple places throughout the bill.
So Representative Hamilton incorporates that same clean up the bill part of the motion. All right. Questions, members? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Then, again, on caregiver, so the issue occurred, question occurred to me that when we do designate caregivers, it's confined to this certification by the doctor or the practitioner that they are developmentally and physically disabled and unable to self-administer medication. The circumstance where someone can self-administer medication but cannot drive to get their medication might arise. So in that instance, then they couldn't have a caregiver. And what they really need the caregiver for is not to come and administer the medication, but to just go get it and bring it to them. And so I asked Ms. Kavanaugh if the committee agrees that's a real issue. Ms. Kavanaugh had a suggestion.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 2, line 30, after medication, insert or acquire medical cannabis from a distribution facility due to the disability.
And I do know there's a few other places I flagged them kind of as we were doing the walkthrough where we would need to incorporate that language. So members, questions, thoughts? Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair, if we want to recess for 10 minutes, we can come back with a bill that I know has been through a number of these committees in this whole process, and I think it'll handle a lot of the problems that we're faced with right now.
So tempting suggestion. So other questions, members? All right. Who would like to make that motion with the cleanup? With the I don't think that was a motion. No, not that motion.
Aye.
So, Representative Hamilton, do you want to continue the tradition?
Sure.
All right.
Yes.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Anything further, members?
Sorry.
You have some? Okay. All right. Anything further? All right. Well, would need to entertain a motion then to...
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call.
All right. Who would like to make the motion, the final motion? Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill as amended by conference committee and direct staff to make the necessary changes that we just adopted and technical changes throughout the bill and prepare the conference committee report.
All right. Questions, members? Anything further? All right. Well, there'll be time for speeches, but let me just say very quickly, thank you for your incredible work, co-chair, and everyone's efforts. It's been tremendous. So all in favor? Oh, excuse me. Roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Moline.
Yes.
Senator Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Lurie.
Yes.
Senator Peterson.
No.
So there being five yeses and one no, the motion passes. Thank you very much. And we are adjourned.